Hey folks, Rob Wolf here, Greg Everett in the house. This is episode 148 of the Paleo Solution Podcast. Dude, what's going on?
Not much. How you doing?
You know, pretty good. Pretty good. Getting a little better sleep. I actually weaned myself into decaf coffee, and I'm actually feeling pretty good with that. I feel like the adrenals are down to the size of like a bowling ball now, so.
Yeah.
And I'm sure I'll suffer some sort of recidivist, you know, backslide at some point. But for right now, I'm marching along doing that. So
what was the motivation for torturing yourself with decaf coffee?
Feeling like I was going to die. Most of it probably related to adrenal dysfunction. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I suppose that's a reasonable enough.
I did an ASI test, and I came back barely alive. So I figured I should probably tweak things a little bit. So, yeah.
Ah, fair enough.
So what's new on
I'm sipping on a cup of coffee as we speak.
I figured as much, so.
I feel like my adrenals are just going to, they're bigger than yours to begin with, so I can take more.
Well, and you're youthful, too. You got ute. Ute as an advantage, so I have no ute. I'm just old.
I got a few years on you.
Yeah. Well, so you guys had a meet?
We did. We had a little weightlifting meet here last weekend, which was fun. Everyone did very well. We qualified the four people that we needed to qualify. So we'll have a good time.
Nice.
American Open here in Palm Springs coming up in December.
Oh, dude, Palm Springs, cool.
Seriously, it's in Palm Springs now instead of it's normally like in Alabama or Ohio or some place that you really don't want to go in December.
Or ever, really.
Well, there's that, too.
Yes. So anything else new, exciting, projects, wingdings?
Oh, man, no.
Okay.
I just have nothing to talk about. I feel like I'm just treading water at this point, trying to keep up with the day-to-day instead of doing interesting, fun, exciting things.
Yeah. Yeah, those days are behind us.
Pretty much. I got two books out. It's time to rest on my laurels.
Exactly. And those laurels had better be big, so.
Yeah. Well, I'm eating for them.
Sweet. Nothing new here. I've started working on the second book a little bit, just chipping away at it. That's about it. So
And so which book is this?
This is the City Zero book. So the kind of food politics, the risk assessment thing in Reno and all that. Nikki actually gave me an idea for an angle that I could approach this thing that would not necessitate me blowing my brains out. So that seemed like a win. So I went for
it. She is helpful.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so what's going on with Skilled Athlete?
Skilled Athlete,
you want to mention some of that
is
stuff?
Cranking along. They're actually getting ready to do kind of a big unveil here in a couple of weeks, and we might get Nikki on the show for that. So, I mean, skilledathlete.com. It's a gym management platform. We've been working with MindBody Online, but it's going to be skill tracking, all kinds of cool stuff. Like if you go to skilledathlete.com, you can download an iPad or an iPhone app. We are not doing Android at this point because there's like 8 zillion more people on Mac platforms than there are on the Android platform. So for now, that's just not going to happen. But go check it out. You can use it for, I think, a month for free or something like that. And there's some really cool data tracking, checking clients in, all kinds of jiggy stuff. So definitely give it a look-see.
Cool.
Yeah.
Exciting stuff in the Nixter.
Indeed.
All right. Well, should we get to the heart of things?
Yeah. Let's do it.
All right. Let's see here.
Squatchy picked out 9 big questions for us, so we'll see how long we can flail around here.
Well, there's a couple of these that could definitely go a few different ways.
Yeah.
So we'll just kind of see what kind of collective mood we're in momentarily.
I've already pictured my head exploding off of a couple of these. So Greg may have to finish the podcast alone. So.
Mine too.
Yeah.
All right. Diet Confusion. Justin says, "Hey, Rob and Greg. First off, I want to thank you for the plethora of knowledge that you drop on us every week. I only recently discovered the Paleo Solution podcast, but I've quickly gone through the last 50 episodes. Suffice to say, you have blown my mind with all of the information you provide, and you're blowing my friends' minds, who all now listen too. There hasn't been this much blowing since insert inappropriate joke here.
Ding.
Totally inappropriate, or excuse me, appropriate considering the conversation we just had prior to pressing record.
So we should just record all of that material as kind of like B tracks, and then charge like a dollar to get into the archives, and people would really go wild, man.
Yeah.
Okay, but I need to lawyer up before we do that. All right. Grady. Anyway, my question has to do with diet confusion, as I call it, for lack of a better term, a la muscle confusion. I'm wondering if the body adapts to one way of eating and needs a change from time to time. Sorry. The muscle confusion term makes me laugh every time because it goes around in this gym quite a bit. Case in point, I tend to get on food kicks where I get into 2 to 3 paleo ingredients and have them all the time. Right now, I really enjoy tuna and pistachios. Don't ask me how that came to be, and tend to include them with most of my meals. My previous hankering was for peanut butter and bananas, which lasted through most of the summer. Don't worry, I have a variety of veggies and low glycemic carbs. I'm not just living off of fish and nuts. Smiley face. With most of my kicks, I initially find great results as I switch up my diet. My energy shoots up both in and out of the gym, and I achieve nice strength gains while dropping 0.5% or so of body fat. After several weeks of a new diet, however, these gains really plateau. I hit a wall where my energy drops and my body fat ticks up. What gives here? Could it be that the body adapts to a new diet, much like it would a new workout routine? Or is this the most ridiculous concept since the Thighmaster? Even if I don't make the podcast, I'd love to hear your thoughts on varying one's diet every so often. Keep up the awesome work. Robert, thoughts?
Well, first, back the fuck down on the Thighmaster, man. I mean, that was a piece of, you know, that is a piece of Americana now. Like, archaeologists in 10,000 years are going to think that was like our you know, religious worship tool during the decline of Western civilization. So just calm down, Justin. So, you know, I one thing, this eating process that you're doing is quite wacky. I just have to say it's pretty wacky, but you know, props to you for keeping some metrics and tracking some stuff and everything. I honestly don't feel like I have a scientifically credible response to this other than you know,
just go with your heart, Rob.
Use your words, Rob. You know, as I've shuffled through all of this nutrition stuff and training stuff and everything, it definitely seems like, you know, the body is a dynamic, adaptive system. It does well with change. And, you know, this is where we see periodized strength training, where we see, you know, cyclic low carb diets, even you know, cyclic caloric content diets. So, you know, you look in the bodybuilding scene and maybe they don't really mess with the macros too much, but you will have significantly like overfed days, underfed days. People seem to find benefit from, you know, weight cutting, fat cutting protocols where they're calorie restricted and stuff like that. And then they report some benefit. And so I could definitely see where like eating, you know, tuna, pistachios, and air would you know, it kind of run you lean or run you dry at some point. I mean, even when we look at like the Inuit diet and stuff like that, which I think would be hard to imagine a more kind of narrow frequency band of eating. It's kind of like, you know, walrus, seal, fish, you know, blubber, maybe a little bit of caribou or something. I mean, it's a pretty narrow frequency band, but even within that, you've got the different organ meats, you've got some sea vegetables, there's a little bit of, it sounds like the Inuit possibly have greater variety than you do. So it's it's just intriguing. And so
and it sounds like just more delicious choices in general.
Possibly,
yeah. I feel about tuna and pistachios.
I would definitely go for seal blubber over tuna on any type of a consistent basis for sure. So yeah, it makes sense that your body would kind of plateau out on this stuff just because you're probably also eating consistent macros. Like it's probably very pedantic, like the same deal all the time. And I think the body does get kind of used to that. Even, you know, in the big time bodybuilder and powerlifting circles, like people are savvy to the idea that if you want to get big and muscular, and even if you're like juiced to the gills on anabolics, your body benefits from a day or two of low protein intake, because as you consume lots and lots of protein,
that protein just starts acting more and more as a fuel substrate instead of it being a building block. And one of the ways that you can kind of press that reset button is cycling macronutrients, having very low carb or protein days. And this all plugs in with, you know, macronutrient cycling and stuff like that. And it really seems to work. It seems to have some good benefit for people. So it makes sense that this could be problematic for you. I would definitely try to throw a little more variety in the mix there. Have some cashews occasionally. So, you know, kick your heels up and go wild.
Yeah. All right. Sumo deadlift high pull and application. Stephanie says, hi. I don't have any formal weight training experience, just anecdotal, my own trial and error, and reading articles and books on various styles of weightlifting, etc.
Shoot, that makes Stephanie probably a level 5 coach in some circles, so.
She's got keys to the spaceship.
Absolutely.
Or if you're riding with Rob, the toaster.
Indeed.
I am writing you, Rob Wolf and Greg Everett, to help me out on something I'm trying to understand. The sumo deadlift high pull is being taught at the gym I go to. It's being taught as a quick movement, powerful like an Olympic lift. I find this confusing because the high pull portion seems to cause so much stress on the shoulder, wrist, and elbow flexion, thinking impingement of shoulder. I cannot think of any reason I would want to perform that movement dynamically. Is there any reason for performing a sumo deadlift high pull quickly? Granted, I have used high pulls with wide to narrow grip training as a competitive bodybuilder, and also used sumo deadlift, but not together dynamically. Thank you for your time, and hopefully another tool I can put into my workout box. Well,
fudge. This is the beginning of the unstitching for us today.
Definitely. I can probably give you a fairly measured response, just because I don't have the energy to get angry about it.
It's because your adrenals are beat up, dude. If you rehab your adrenals, you could get angry again. Meaner.
Oh, man.
Meaner.
Ah, to be young. Yeah, I agree with you that I really don't see a point of a sumo deadlift high pull. I never really understood it from day one of my CrossFit indoctrination. I think it was more kind of a novelty thing more than anything. And unfortunately, based on its history, it's kind of become this core exercise in the CrossFit world, which to me is
appalling.
Just absolutely nonsensical. I don't really share your concern necessarily about the safety issues because of it being dynamic. And I mean, as a matter of fact, I would say it's less problematic in this case than it would be doing a slow kind of upper body only narrow grip high pull, simply because you are really just following through on the momentum on the bar that you've generated from your legs rather than actually lifting the bar very much with your arms. So if you're going to do them, I would do them somewhat dynamically, but I also wouldn't do a lot of close grip high pulls. Like, we do snatch grip high pulls and things like that, which I really haven't seen any shoulder problems from, unless you have someone with an existing problem or who has horrible flexibility, in which case, obviously, you need to go about all things you do a little bit differently. But those are always done, you know, dynamically, with the bar being accelerated first with the legs and hips, and then the arms are more of a follow-through. So, yeah, long story short, I just wouldn't do sumo deadlifts. And honestly, if you're the people running your gym genuinely believe that a sumo deadlift high pull is in any way related to the Olympic lifts or is somehow going to help teach you the Olympic lifts, I would not have a lot of confidence in their abilities as coaches. Rob, any further thoughts?
A few. one thing, and I really like the point that you made, that actually a dynamic flavor of this is actually going to be less potentially traumatic as far as an impingement injury on the shoulder. I don't think the little book exists anymore. There used to be this cool little maybe 80-page, 90-page book called The 7-Minute Rotator Cuff Solution.
Yes, and I remember that. I have it as a PDF somewhere.
Yeah, it's an outstanding book. And
it's still out there.
It's still floating around. So when this thing popped up on the scene, God, it had to be late 80s, early 90s, I would say.
Yeah, I remember it from like the mid 90s.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
It's been around.
And so, you know, the high pull was a movement that was very common in bodybuilding. It develops traps, rear delts. I mean, it's a great muscular development tool for like kind of like thick, beefy shoulders and all that. The problem, though, is that it puts that internal rotation of the humerus. You have this tendency to really impinge the supraspinatus tendon as it goes through the acromion. And the dude did a nice little analysis of this impingement potential and really admonished people, for the love of God, don't do the high pull. And so for a long time, the high pull had kind of disappeared out of use. Like, this guy's education efforts were effective, and even in the bodybuilding scene, like, you just didn't see high pulls all that much. Like, you started seeing more shrugs or clean pulls, and consequently you saw rotator cuff issues kind of drop off. So historically that's kind of an interesting piece just in the high pull in general. And then, you know, in the beginnings of CrossFit, the founders of the movement were not actually that sophisticated on the Olympic lifts. And as my friends from the South would say, shut the front door. this movement was theoretically a bridge between like the slow lifts of the deadlift and the quick lifts of like a power clean or a power snatch. And I think the theory was intriguing, but, you know, then the application of the type of movement patterns that you generate are horrible. Like the tendency for early arm bend, the tendency for high hip, kind of recruitment and stuff like that. And it's one of these illustrations of where, the type of training that you do just goes so horribly wrong compared to the way that you would do something in real life. So, like, when we were getting Glenn ready for some of his fights, I liked a fight gone bad type of workout for a diagnostic tool. But I'm looking at the amount of, mileage that we're putting on his shoulders from grappling and from boxing and everything, and I just looked at the how little I liked the sumo deadlift high pull. And I was like, okay, what's actually going to be helpful for this guy? And that would be the hang power clean and, really grip intensive, loaded to maybe 95 pounds. So you get some quick turnover. You're still moving the weight, rapidly and all that sort of stuff. And this was just really, really effective. And what I found in the course of Glenn using a hang power clean at high repetition in a conditioning modality, and again, this was mainly as a diagnostic tool, but obviously you get some conditioning benefit even from the diagnostic workout. But when I saw Glenn doing this movement, he had a tendency to, you go from that hip back, chest upright position in the hang power clean, violent upward hip extension, get a gentle brush, rebending of the knees to catch the clean. And then instead of having him stand up tall to finish the movement, his natural athletic instinct was to catch it in a slight knee bend, use a little bit of a shoulder bump to bump it off of his shoulders, reset the hips, and then catch it on the way down, which is actually incredibly athletic. And if you see people training folks for athletic endeavors and using kind of like doubles or triples and like the hang power clean or something like that to teach kind of repetitious hip extension, this is the natural movement that actually emulates sports. And people who are naturally athletic, I'm thinking about like John Fragoso and some other people that we've had in the gym. You take somebody who is a top of the food chain athlete, a wrestler, volleyball player, whatever, and you just show them the rudiments of like a hang power clean, and they will inevitably do it this same way, where they, instead of like coming tall, just so we have this arbitrary finish point, like that doesn't happen. No rep. And so this is another interesting piece to this. And I was listening to a Jim Laird podcast. He was interviewing Kiefer, and they were mainly talking about food. But it was interesting. Kiefer ended up talking about like cone drills and stuff like that in this notion that, usually people use cone drills to try to improve what we would call agility. But in fact, all it's doing is it's entraining a particular motor pattern that really isn't specific to being agile on the athletic field. You're getting good at dance moves, basically, and that's it. And
this is another one of these pieces where, you know, a lot of the programming that goes into kind of CrossFit-esque stuff, I love CrossFit. It's good, you know, a lot of our client, you know, obviously this is a kind of a foundational piece of how we do a lot of our clientele type stuff. But the sumo deadlift height pole we removed, and we use other movements in place of that. The way that we do our box jumps now for the bulk of our clients once they get reasonably athletic, I'm less concerned about a full hip open than I am them dynamically doing a box jumps in a legit way, which we tend not to do super high volume on that stuff. It's more like fives and then another movement instead of doing like 50s and stuff like that. So, you know, there's bigger picture stuff here, even beyond just the, large loads, long distances, quickly, and being able to measure where you started and where you finished and all that stuff. I guess that's all nice for, like, competitive CrossFit type stuff. But then there's this world of actually making people more athletic and ingraining good movement that's going to be, you know, beneficial for your life. And the type of movement that you ingrain on a sumo deadlift high pole has, I just can't think of any benefit for it out in the real world. The things that you get from a power clean, a power snatch, clean pulls, snatch pulls, as far as the developmental tools, just infinitely superior. And then if you want to drop in and do something for a CrossFit burner, or say like you want to compete or something like that, if you have aptitude with the basic Olympic lifts, doing a sumo deadlift high pull is not going to be a big deal. Like, you have all the motor patterns that you need. You look at it, and then it's like, okay, this is obvious how I do this shit, you know. So, yeah, that probably went way further than what...
Are you sure that's decaf that you're drinking?
Yeah, these are my adrenals functioning. I can actually think for a change, so...
That's weird.
So, yeah, I'm sure that was way more than what Stephanie was looking for. But, you know, this is some stuff for coaches to think about. It's like, why are you using a movement? You know, and not just fucking polishing the knob of the people who are telling you these things are good or bad. Even for me, I mean, it's like, assume I'm wrong, but at least get in and think about it and tinker with stuff and see how this stuff plays out. See how people are doing things in other arenas and why they're successful and why... Do people coach the Olympic lifts in the way that they do? Why do they coach the progressions that they do? And, you know, like you do occasionally see a thruster as part of Olympic weightlifting training, really rarely, and it's typically performed from the back. But you never see a sumo deadlift high pull. It doesn't exist in the lexicon of Olympic weightlifting. So,
yes. All right. Well,
so that was my head explosion. Here's
this. I don't have the energy to let my head explode on perfect. This one either. But Peter says, I know bad grammar make Greg mad, so I try to be okay. The article Greg wrote on feet forward versus feet pointed out during the squat was very interesting. While watching the Olympics, I noticed that the athletes performing the clean and jerk pointed their feet forward during the first pull, which he considers a deadlift, and feet out during the front squat. Though I've also noticed most of their knees go valgus because they're lifting too much weight. Could you expand on what you said about the knee rotating and stretching non-stretchable soft tissue? On the topic of Kelly Starrett, he recently posted a video talking about reducing inflammation with icing to not be such a good idea. Did you watch this, and what is your take on it? Also, what's up with Rob's eyebrows? In most interview videos I've watched, he has this ability to always talk with one eyebrow raised. Thought I'd just mention it so he would get super conscious of it now. Good job in spearing that beast in I, Caveman, by the way.
I've trained my eyebrows. I can raise them independently, kind of Spock style. So, yeah, thank you for noticing.
Good. It just gives you a whole other range of possible expressions.
Yes. And when I start making one raise and the other lower back and forth while Zoe is looking at me, it puts her into a catatonic state immediately. So it's pretty cool.
Use it while you can.
Yeah. Yeah.
And by the way, this email was subject lined Greg Ebert versus Kelly Starrett. So let me first of all say that I'm really not interested in being on one side of a versus. So let's really, I'm not trying to make enemies or beat up on anybody out there. And for some reason, that article about the knees thing turned into Greg Ebert versus Kelly Starrett, when it was really just me responding to people asking me what I thought about what Kelly was saying, and that's what I thought. So simple as that. It's nothing personal. Regarding the the Olympics, I don't know if I would agree with your observation that most of their knees go valgus. I'd say that, yeah, quite a few of them do. But yes, it's the Olympics. These guys are lifting some of the heaviest weights you ever see lifted in the history of the world. That's not going to look perfect in most cases. And a lot of times part of the reason is that when you are trying to snatch or clean extremely heavy weights, especially nearing your own max effort, you're going to end up naturally throwing your feet out wider than you normally would. And when your feet are too wide, your knees are going to go valgus when you stand up. There's just really no way around it. It's not an indication of poor training or poor muscular recruitment or anything like that. It's just a simple structural thing. So I don't know if I would really worry too much about that. As far as what I said about the knee rotating, I think about the joint. It's a hinge joint. It's not meant to rotate. You take anything mechanical out there and you make it do things it wasn't designed to do, it's going to break it. You can demonstrate that with any children's toy because they fucking break all of them and you have to keep replacing them. So, yeah, there's a little bit of play in the knee. It's not an absolute locked in, perfectly rigid hinge joint, but you don't really want to push the limits of that unnecessarily. And so what I'm saying is that that joint, like all joints, is surrounded by non-elastic connective tissue to maintain the integrity of that joint. And if you continually put that joint into positions where that non-elastic connective tissue is being forced to stretch, eventually it's going to be looser than it's supposed to be. You know, ligaments don't just naturally shrink back to what they're supposed to be if you've stretched them somehow. There's some kind of surgery where they basically, like, it's like taking a hair dryer to shrink wrap. But I've heard that the results of that are really unreliable and generally not good. So you definitely don't want to test it out. As far as the ice and inflammation thing, I did not watch that video. I kind of kept a little bit of an eye on what was going on, but not really. And first of all, this is not my area of expertise. I'm not a physical therapist. I'm not a medical practitioner of any kind. So, you know, take everything I say with a large grain of salt, but I would agree that there are definitely a lot of cases where ice is overused or used inappropriately. I agree that, you know, the NSAIDs and all that kind of stuff generally should not be used, especially for pain management. I mean, that's honestly with the pain management stuff, if you're just like saying, hey, I'm sore, I'm going to take some ibuprofen, then you probably just need to rub some chalk in it and walk it off. if you're talking about an athlete who is, you know, a competitive athlete at a high level who has to train, like you just don't have the option of, hey, I'm going to take 3 weeks off because my knee is kind of sore, I think your choices are going to be a little bit different than, say, you know, relative to your average kind of CrossFitter who's like, hey, I'm feeling kind of beat up. So in the first case, the competitive athlete, there may be times when you're going to use ibuprofen or you're going to use ice in order to allow yourself to get through a particularly bad period of training. And you're not doing it to say like, hey, this is the best thing that's going to heal this thing up. You're doing it to say, hey, this is kind of a stopgap treatment to get me through this to a point where I can address this thing more appropriately for the long term. That being said, my general take on ice, and this is based on my own experience and also just talking with a few practitioners that I trust who I know work with athletes, and all of them are familiar with weightlifting in particular, and that is that generally ice is probably going to be more appropriate for muscular injuries, not for avascular tissues like your tendons and ligaments. And that generally you probably don't want to be doing it too long. So the 20 minutes of icing is probably a bit too much. Maybe we're talking more like the 5 to 10 minute sort of thing. And then also, contrast is generally going to be a better approach for pretty much anything. And then the compression, I think, typically is a good idea also, and then appropriate movement. So all those things, there are a number of those things that I definitely agree with Kelly on, but what I don't agree with is saying we can't ice. Ice is bad. It's not ice is bad or good. It's just that there are times when ice is inappropriate and there are times when ice is appropriate, and you have to kind of know those things and be smart about what you're doing.
I like
thoughts
it.
Thoughts on that one?
I'll just throw in a couple of thoughts here. Like the original, I remember Kelly did a piece where he was talking about the toes forward to enhance torque production. And we had a podcast where I kind of ran through my thoughts on that. Like for general athletic development for an individual that's got the, you know, the range of movement in the ankle, the knee, the hips, you know, back is all tied together, that toes forward squat for general athletic development, I think is great. Like Rafael Ruiz and lots of other coaches at his level who actually work with a huge number of professional athletes, this is what they do. And then they do something shocking, which is they use quarter squats for most of their athletes. You know, which
I was just going to say, all the professional coaches that I have ever talked to about this, a lot of them do squat toes forward, but not one of them ever squats below parallel.
Right.
So it's a completely different ball game.
And so, you know, which in the large loads, long distances, quickly kind of scene, people would fucking lose their mind because, again, they're trying to take one thing and apply it to all situations. And, you know, it's not that these people who are dealing with million-dollar athletes are stupid. In fact, that, you know, every once in a while, other people besides Greg Glassman got shit right in exercise science.
Get the shit out of town.
Yeah. And so, you know, within that context, it's like, okay, so a toes forward squat, we're going to go a quarter depth. We're going to do these fairly high frequency because we're trying to, you know, emulate the patterns that we see in that violent hip extension. We're working on hip torsion and stuff like that. We're going to get more full joint range of movement activities from like unilateral work, lunges, box step ups, and stuff like that. Like, this is standard run of the mill stuff. Now, if you're into exclusively like the sport of fitness and everything needs to be the same range of movement every single repetition, then this may not work because you know it's a different deal. But you know, depending on where you're going with that boat, again, it's tools that can be used in a variety of ways. And then within the Olympic lifting scene, which I barely could carry Greg's gym bag with regards to Olympic lifting knowledge, but if you toe your feet out, you are you're creating a situation in which the combined center of gravity is more favorable for you and getting that weight up versus having the toes forward. And so in that regard, you know, people are going to toe out more in Olympic lifting, and Olympic lifters are known to be good general athletes when they get tested. But again, their deal is Olympic weightlifting. So you're going to squat in a way that is most beneficial for that. And so again, you know, maybe not that much controversy, just unfortunately not a one size fits all kind of gig. And then, you know, with the inflammation deal and icing and all that, I for years, like I remember Fred Hatfield back, God, again, you know, late 80s, early 90s, he was quoting a bunch of Russian literature that was saying that post injury, you know, like a sprain or strain, that they would subject the area to heat and actually create like a huge inflammatory response. A day or two later, start using contrast methods to move the fluid and inflammation out of there, and they felt like they had better recovery. And when you think about like hormetic stressors and immune response and stuff like that, it totally makes sense. But again, like what Greg just alluded to, if you've got a knee that is so, like if the popliteal fossa is so swollen with fluid that you cannot move your knee and you have to get out and play that day because it's your JOB, then you would better get some sort of anti-inflammatory action, some manual lymphatic drainage, probably some icing to get all that inflammation down so that you can, in fact, have normal knee function. And there again, you know, I think that, you know, it's a case of we probably just went too far on one side. Like we just went bananas on the icing and using continual passive movement units hooked up to cryopacks and stuff like that, and it makes it feel good. The pain goes down and everything, which obviously has some benefit, but there may be some downside to that. And so we just need to be possibly a bit more sophisticated in how we roll that stuff out. And then the final thought on that, I guess, is just that if you have somebody who is massively inflamed because of horrible diet, bad sleep, etc., you may have to default to ice, in my opinion, because they're so fucked up that you don't really want things to get much worse. And so, again, like, are we talking about a healthy, insulin normal kind of population? Are we talking about a hyperinsulinemic, quasi-autoimmune individual who tripped and went down a flight of stairs and they're all fucked up? Like, do you treat that person the same way you do an athlete? I don't know. That person might really benefit from some icing with their bruised knee or bruised elbow because their inflammatory response is so over the top that you don't really want that thing to get too much of a feed forward mechanism.
Yeah. The one more thing I would add to that is that I think it was Kelly who said in his original blog post about this, something like, you know, do we really think that the body doesn't know how to treat these things? And that seems like a cool theory, like, yeah, the body must know how to do this, so why are we interfering? But if you stop and think about it, the answer is no, it doesn't necessarily know how to treat these things right. One, because we're potentially exposing the body to things that it's not prepared for, like these high-end athletic endeavors are not necessarily natural, or either, you know, weightlifting is definitely not paleo, you know, at least at a high competitive level. But the other thing, too, is that there's plenty of examples of the body completely reacting inappropriately or to extremes. And the perfect example is, you know, allergic reactions. Mm-hmm. I mean, you think anaphylaxis is a reasonable response, you know, so you can't just fall back on this weird idea that, well, the body must know exactly what is perfectly correct for every situation. Unfortunately, you can't just rely on that, as convenient as it would be. So
I think having some awareness about where to intervene and where to let things roll is smart, but that's a great point.
All right. Paleo and cataracts. David says, I'm 74 and with moderate cataracts, surgery planned. Since I was 27, I've eaten mostly what I'd call, quote, natural foods. That is, lots of veggies, fruit, and loads of whole grains, but with plenty of meat, lots of southern fried chicken. Until recently, my blood pressure was 120 over 80, although it is sometimes higher now. I've had fairly high cholesterol for years, but refused meds, thinking I could deal with it via nutrition and exercise. Other than that and the cataracts, I am, as far as I know, healthy. No aches, pains, or limitations. So my question is, while I understand that if I had eaten paleo all along, I might not have developed cataracts, can eating paleo now do anything to reverse the cataracts? Thanks.
So a couple of things. One thing is that 120 over 80 blood pressure, that really makes me wonder about insulin resistance. Like, that is way higher than what I would want to see. Like a diastolic blood pressure, the one on the bottom, the lower number, anything over 70, I start getting really nervous. I start thinking about insulin resistance, which, God, every time the aldosterone thing comes up, it just gives me a little bit of a chuckle. But anyway, you know, insulin goes up, aldosterone goes up. When aldosterone goes up, we retain sodium. When we retain sodium, we retain water, and that makes blood pressure go up. And so I would be really curious to know how you would respond to a ketogenic diet. Like, I would be super curious to see if that brought your blood pressure down a bunch because of the diuretic effect. And so that's one potential benefit of a ketogenic diet in that scenario. Another potential benefit is that the cataracts are an accumulation of reactive oxygen species damage in this product called lipofuscin, which is this incompletely metabolized kind of fat backbone, which accumulates in the eye and basically causes clouding and obscuring. And one of the interesting features of ketosis, again, is that you tend to ramp up these cellular detoxification pathways, and you actually can remove lipofuscin from cells. And people who are aging what we would typically call normal in Western terms, by the time they're in their like 70s or 80s, like a significant amount of the cell is taken up with just lipofuscin, just this kind of fatty, waxy nastiness that is the accumulation of incompletely metabolized lipid products. And ketosis has the ability to remove these lipofusion products out of the cell and therefore not push out the other organelles and allow for normal kind of cell functioning and stuff. So I have never seen a study. I've never seen a specific example of somebody, reporting that their cataracts ended up improving. I've seen a ton of people that, myself included, who had some blood sugar swing issues when I was eating higher carb, and then when I started eating more ketogenic or cyclic ketogenic, like some of the vision problems that I had ended up going away because I wasn't getting the blood sugar swings, which can move fluids in and out of the eye in kind of a dramatic fashion and isn't very good for the eyes. So I wouldn't be surprised if ketosis helped the cataracts. If it didn't help the cataracts, it would certainly benefit both the recovery, you know, eating ketogenic and but having some antioxidant-rich veggies and stuff like that. Going into the surgery, I think you would have better surgery outcome, better recovery, and you would most likely not see the cataracts return because you're removing the main mechanism of causation, these reactive oxygen species, which are mainly a spillover from kind of hyperinsulinemic adaptations. And then you also have a cell detoxification pathway removing that lipofusion, which is kind of the primary problem with the cataracts. So it'd be interesting, you know, if you did some tinkering. I think that you could build a good argument just on the blood pressure side to do a little bit of tinkering with the ketosis, and then it should benefit the eyes too. And it'd be very interesting if you did some tinkering with that stuff to see what the results are.
Way cool.
Sweet.
All right. HIV and the paleo diet. Melanie says, one of my children has recently found out that she is HIV positive. We're still waiting on the Western blot test to make sure she did not get a false positive. But I'm wondering if there have been any indications that going paleo would help to prolong her time without meds. Any information would be appreciated, as I am not an advocate for Western medicine, and the longer she can stay off the meds, the better, in my opinion.
So, you know, I'm obviously not a doctor. Take all this stuff as informational, non-prescriptive, all of those exculpatory clause type things. But, you know, I like to be kind of, I guess, naturalistic in the approach to medicine that I'm kind of thinking about. But there is a reality that some things like vaccines and antibiotics and antiretrovirals and stuff are amazingly effective at keeping people alive. And so if your daughter has even been suspected of being exposed to HIV, and it looks like she's got at least, you know, one diagnostic test that confirmed that, I cannot think of a reason why you would not be aggressively tackling the antiretrovirals and the protease inhibitors, which are kind of the standard cocktail for HIV treatment. Like, it just seems crazy to me to not do that, because they've actually seen examples where, you know, the early administration of these drugs, the HIV ends up getting cleared at some point. So this is a situation where I wouldn't go too granola on this thing. Like, there are some really effective drugs that, you know, HIV used to eventually progress into AIDS and kill you, and it doesn't typically do that now. So I wouldn't really mess with it.
Look at Magic Johnson.
Yeah, yeah.
That guy is bigger and more jacked than he ever was.
Yeah. So, I would keep that in mind. And then on the other side of this thing, where paleo would be beneficial, I had some studies and about the main difference between being HIV infected and having full-blown AIDS, where your immune system starts tanking, is the disruption in gut permeability. Like, that seems to be the thing that goes south, allows this huge influx of bacterial endotoxins and all kinds of environmental inputs into your system, and that insult combined with the general impact of the HIV virus on the T cells is what leads to the end, basically. It just looks eerily like a bunch of these gastrointestinal related issues that we see, you know, stemming from grain consumption, stress, a host of different things. So eating a paleo diet, having good vitamin D levels, getting adequate sleep, like, that all just seems like, you know, it's important for any type of mechanistic thing that you could think about with regards to staving off that HIV status. And then that, to me, combined with, you know, antiretroviral and protease inhibitor use, that seems like a really smart thing to do. If the individual is male, then you can also throw testosterone therapy into the mix. There was a book called Built to Survive, which was actually written in the had a really heavy following in like the gay population. And before the antiretrovirals were available, people looked at the fact that AIDS was a wasting disease, that you ended up losing muscle mass. And so some people started experimenting with anabolic use, and these people survived and they thrived. And then they started getting incarcerated for having, scheduled drugs on their person, which actually was saving their life. But it's an interesting thing. Like that was a really, really effective treatment for people before the advent of the antiretrovirals and stuff like that. So,
All right. This subject line is just to get someone fired up, namely Rob. Also, brown nosing, great talk at AHS 12. Kate says, Dear Rob and Greg, hello. I've listened to almost every single podcast, and I'm a huge fan. I want to say something sassy and clever, but right now I'm like one of those middle schoolers overthinking the coolest lines in my head, so I'm just going to skip it. I just saw this in the New York Times and felt a little bit of rage. However, as I am not an expert, I wanted to throw it out to you two for analysis. It is Dr. Jules Hirsch shooting down the recent JAMA study showing people on a high-fat diet burning more calories than they consumed. In the interview, he also references a similar study he did where they measured, and then the sentence is just
drops off.
So I don't know what they measured. I was wondering, what do you think of his analysis of the study, and what do the different results of the two studies say? Additionally, could Dr. Hirsch have been right about the difficulty in measuring energy output? He seems to blame calorie differences on lost water weight, but here I'm confused. If a calorie is a calorie is a calorie, why isn't a pound a pound? Here's a link to the New York Times interview. Here's a link to what I believe may be the study Dr. Hirsch refers to in the interview. A little background. I just saw Gary Taubes speak at the AHS 12, and I believe he references the same JAMA study, but obviously he had a different interpretation.
Yeah, so this Dr. Hirsch, it just, yeah, the stuff, it's painful in a way. You know, if you stick people in metabolic ward settings where you're controlling exactly what people are eating, at the end of the day, the calorie deal ends up being a huge factor. Like, it's hard to start distinguishing differences between a high-carb diet, a low-carb diet, and stuff like that if you're giving people isocaloric feeding and whatnot. We do see some definite differences between, say, like just simply weight loss, which could be water, fat, or muscle, versus the actual fat loss. And typically on the lower carb diets, we see better fat loss, more muscle retention, possibly even lean body weight gain. And what Dr. Hirsch dismisses in this, I'm sure was accounted for in the methodology, and it would be goofy if it was not. The paper that's linked is not, in fact, the paper that he's talking about and the one that Gary Taubes was talking about, but I remember reading that one. And, even if we – God, there's so many layers to this thing. Even if the calorie – which is funny, there was just a thing in science, I think, where they were saying a calorie isn't a calorie, and more people are kind of gearing up to that. So, understanding the different metabolic pathways and hormonal results and all that sort of jive – But let's say that the calorie is a calorie story is true. That's only one piece of the picture. There's also the stuff that Stefan Guyanet talks about constantly, which is like the palatability, the neuroregulation of appetite. And macronutrients absolutely are not equal in that regard. So let's just say that the propeller heads are correct. The calorie is a calorie. It doesn't matter what macros you eat. It all comes down to eating less. Even then, which I don't think that's accurate, but even then, let's say that is a 100% accurate, that there's no metabolic advantage to eating higher protein and lower carb and stuff like that. we still know for a fact that hyperpalatable foods cause people to overeat. So simply telling people to, which is what Dr. Hirsch said in the interview, continue eating the food that you're eating, just eat less of it. If you're fucking eating Twinkies and Ding Dongs, you can't eat less because you can't stop until you've like held up, you know, till you've done a carjacking to, or like sold your body on the streets to get more money to go buy more of that food because it's so cracky and addictive and yummy. So it's that part of the equation never seems to get woven together. You know, the fact that there are legitimate metabolic differences between the type of macronutrients that we eat, and then we're not even considering the differences in the way that those foods hit the gut and are then metabolized by gut bacteria and all kinds of inflammatory signaling there. And then the other piece of this is that, you know, what type of foods are you going to be overeat on and which ones are you not going to overeat on? And, you know, chicken, fish, steak, sweet potatoes, broccoli, like it's hard as hell to overeat that stuff. French bread drizzled in garlic butter is really easy to overeat. So, you know, that's another piece of this thing that it's funny, the propeller heads like this Dr. Hirsch have been telling people to just eat less for a long time, and it doesn't fucking work. So these assholes need to come up with something different. And this guy, you know, it's like I want to put a electric shock collar on these people when they say this shit. And then, you know, each time somebody dies from metabolic derangement that could have been prevented, they you know, it's like somewhere in the ether they just get zapped from this stuff because it's obviously not working. We keep telling people largely the same story, but it's not, you know, it's obviously not working very well. So...
Indeed. All right. Well, speaking of getting fat,
now the other side.
Called 7 month old is not fat enough. Tim, Kristen, and Zoe say, Rob, I've been an avid listener of yours for a while now and have been eating paleo for about 2 years. My wife, reluctant at first, started eating paleo-ish while she was pregnant and post-pregnancy went full paleo and is now 100% paleo now that she sees and feels the effects. Our problem now is that our 7 month old isn't gaining enough weight to please the pediatricians. She was exclusively breastfed for the first 6 months and now eats real solid foods, peas, carrots, sweet potatoes, chicken, pears, apples, and avocado. We keep upping her solid food content, but her metabolism is crazy high and she seems to burn off everything that she eats. The pediatrician now is strongly urging us to give her formula a few times a day and add some grain snacks and infant cereal. I don't have a realistic option to go to a new doctor because I'm in the military and our health care options are limited. She's hitting all of her developmental markers and everything else is great. They just want to plump her up. A friend of ours has twins that were born at the same weight as our daughter and was the same weight at 3 months. They started them on formula and they ballooned up, literally, and they look swollen and frankly unhealthy. Should we be worried about the low weight if she's hitting all of her cognitive and developmental markers and is otherwise healthy? Are there any other healthy foods we can add to give her more food that will help her grow? I know you usually deal with 24-year-old dudes that want to bulk up, not 7-month-olds, but maybe now that you have a new addition to the wolf pack, you can understand my frustration and confusion. Thanks.
So this whole thing is 100% an artifact of your pediatrician looking at the standards which come out of the United States instead of pulling from the World Health Organization standards, which pull from the world and typically sees people who are breastfeeding, you know, for upwards of a year. And so when you look at the numbers and the recommended body weight projections for babies from the United States, it's like an order of magnitude larger than what the WHO recommendations are. And that is because fewer than 15% of people breastfeed at all in the United States. Virtually all the babies are formula fed, and the formula is very high caloric content, it's much more insulinogenic, and the babies get way bigger, way faster on formula. So, fuck, man. Like this.
That's
the quick answer. If you want to do a little Google searching or ask the pediatrician to just please look at the WHO data instead of the United States data, and then your baby is going to be right in line with that. Luckily, our pediatrician pulls from the WHO data, and he's happy as a clam with the progress that Zoe is making. But Zoe is like off the scales on all of the developmental stuff. rolling over, eye contact, grip strength, like all of that stuff, she's off the Richter. But then when you look at her developmental parameters, she's like, you know, super high on the height, but then she's like 58th percentile on the weight. So for the average pediatrician, they would say that she's under-eating, but she's breastfeeding all the fucking time. So, how, you know, we were just kind of shooting down biology, you know, that you can't always rely on biology and stuff like that. But when it comes to feeding a baby, it's kind of like, you know, they are going to eat enough to, you know, be provided what they need, unless the mom is having, like, some production issues or something like that. So, yeah, the long and short, check out the WHO recommendations that basically pulls out the formula-fed babies and focuses on breastfed babies only, and then we're actually comparing apples to apples.
Yeah, and it should be pretty reassuring to you with the fact that all of her other markers are spot on, especially the cognitive stuff. So, I mean, it seems like I wouldn't worry a ton about it.
An underfed baby will not have normal cognitive development. That is, you know, the classic scenario of when you're looking at an underfed baby, which interestingly you actually see a lot of this stuff in like the vegan community, because neither, even if the mother is breastfeeding, the mother's breast milk is so nutrient deficient that the baby's not doing well. And then beyond that, you know, it's a clear indication that when the baby has a failure to thrive, there's a lack of body weight gain and there's a lack of normal kind of psychomotor development. And you're not seeing any of that. So to just simply look at this and be like, well, your baby's not obese yet like all the other ones, so we need to plump them up, that's fucking ridiculous.
Yeah. All right. Speeding up keto adaptation. Ben says, hey, Rob, how's it going? First off, I bought your book and liked it. Definitely the
best
paleo
book. Well, at least one person did. That's good.
I've bought so far. People either love your book or they hate it or they think it's okay. So yeah, I work in a warehouse and eat a super unhealthy diet to get through the day. Enormous amount of carbs. Every time I try to go keto while working, I always can't get keto adapted fast enough and my quota plummets and I get in trouble. Vinny and Volek seems to think it can't be done in less than 2 weeks, but I'm not sold on that. Basically, so far, this is what I think would yield the fastest keto adaptation time. 1. After eating coca oil, go on a 48-hour fast. 2. Begin eating a healthy keto diet heavy in coconut oil. Would walking be detrimental or beneficial? I can't figure out what this study means. And there's a link, of course. Thanks for any help you can provide.
I think this is actually a pretty smart way to get into ketosis rapidly. The really heavy use of coconut oil is going to produce ketone bodies very, very quickly, which is going to spare as much glucose for the brain and as much glucose for the rest of your body as you can. The ketone bodies still take some time to really ramp up as a fuel substrate in the muscles, and the muscles usually shift more into just fatty acid oxidation anyway. But I think this is a pretty slick way to do this, and you could do some anaerobic intervals in there, like some high intensity intervals on that first day, doing either some upper body or lower body, you know, like a Schwinn Aerodyne, you know, mixed with a Concept 2 rower would drop glycogen stores like crazy. So that would be good. This would be a really harsh kind of introduction to all this stuff, but I think that it would get you kicked over about as fast as anything is going to do.
Cool. Yeah, don't get fired.
Yeah, don't get fired.
Okay, macronutrient ratios for fats. Nikki says, dear Rob and Greg, love your show and look forward to Tuesday, listening to you all the way from London, England. It's become particularly funny recently for me to hear Rob reference his family. My daughter is called Zoe, and I'm Nikki, too. Okay, I'm really hoping you guys can help me. I just have to say, like, it always cracks me up. I don't know why, like, with the British way of talking about how people are named something, but they're called Zoe.
Right.
That's like what we use to tell people what we call them, like, behind their back. Like, her name is Zoe, but we call her asshole.
Right.
All right. Okay, I'm really hoping you guys can help me out here, as I've been searching for the last piece of the paleo puzzle. I understand that PUFAs are not good, but nowhere can I find a recommended amount of saturated fat, monounsaturated fat, and polyunsaturated fats one should have daily. I've been paleo for 5 months now, and I am still confused about the macronutrient ratios of fat. Sorry, the spelling here is just wacky. As a former researcher for the BBC, you'd think I'd be able to track down this information, but alas, I have not. If it was that easy, we wouldn't have this podcast.
Indeed.
I use FitnessPal to keep track of what I eat and use their custom settings for my carbs, 10%, protein, 20%, and fat, 70%. Last week, I heard the Australian writer David Gillespie, Fear of Fat, say one shouldn't have more than 6 grams of PUFA, so I've now got that value. Please, can you tell me how much of the other two fats I should aim for? I'm 5'8", 133 pounds, or 60 kilos, and 11.2% body fat. I do 3 strength sessions a week. Cheers, as the Brits say.
Indeed, they do say that. I'm a little flummoxed, again, what to say here, because like if you are eating lean meat, you know, if you're eating grass-fed meat, seafood, fruits, veggies, roots, tubers, some nuts and seeds, like unless you are eating tons of, say, like, you know, mayonnaise or something, I just...
McSchmalionaise?
Yeah, I don't really see how you're going to steer the boat really one way or another. So I don't know that it really matters all that much, because are you going to dramatically... So are you just going to eat coconut to get more saturated fat? Are you going to reduce olive oil so that you don't have as much monos? And if you are eating these foods, then I don't really see the amount of polyunsaturated fats that you're getting to be an issue at all. So I feel like I'm possibly failing you here, but I think that this may be a level of detail orientation that really is not necessary, and there's really not that much that you're going to do to alter these fatty acid ratios to any significant degree, again, unless what was the first guy, Joel or Justin, you know, unless you're going to eat only tuna and coconut, we're not going to change your fatty acid ratio that you're taking in all that much. And if you're generally eating whole unprocessed paleo-esque foods, I think you're kind of kicking ass as much as you could, and you don't really need the part of the beauty of it is you don't need to sweat too much more than that. You know, maybe you think a little bit of macronutrient cycling, some cyclic low carb, sticking carbs post-workout, stuff like that, but that doesn't seem all that hard either. That actually seems to make life simpler to me, you know, relative to the zone where you're trying to get every damn meal exactly the same proportion and all that jive. So Greg, is this a failure answer? I mean, I just don't see how you can really dial this stuff in one way or another without becoming really wacky, becoming Justin in your eating style. So
yeah, I would say you're definitely overthinking it, Nikki. I really don't see anything good coming from getting this thing dialed into some super precise ratio. And I don't think anyone, even if you knew how to find it, I don't think there's anyone who's going to be able to tell you exactly what the perfect ratio is anyway.
And then going back to the, you know, Justin's original question, like the body benefits from change in dynamicism. And so I would maybe try to eat seasonally a little bit. I would switch stuff up. Like I you know, the polyunsaturated fat deal is, if you are already if you are hyperinsulinemic, loads of oxidative stress, then the ingestion of lots of polyunsaturated fats is probably a horrible idea. If you're not metabolically broken, I don't see it being a huge problem. And then even the step further is that I don't know how you get a ton of polyunsaturated fats unless you're drinking like, flaxseed oil by the gallon or using like a half a gallon of, mayonnaise for your meals and stuff like that. And the interesting thing, even within that, if you're on a ketogenic diet, then it seems like you metabolize the oxidative stress from polyunsaturated fats is completely different than even when you're consuming a standard kind of, you know, medium carbohydrate intake. So, yeah, it's an interesting question, but I just don't see any real way to address it without becoming neurotic about food. And I don't see any way that you could address it that's really going to turbocharge things more than just doing some simple like cyclic low carb eating, some nutrient partitioning, stuff like that.
I concur.
Is that everything?
That's it.
Sweet.
Hour and 4 minutes.
Dude, we're like clockwork, man.
Right?
We'll credit it all to Squatchy for precisely picking just the right amount of freak-out-worthy questions versus concise answers. So
there you go.
Yeah.
Quite a team we make.
Indeed. Indeed.
So, all right. Well,
I guess that's it, man.
That is it.
I can't think of anything else. So I guess same bat time, same bat channel next week.
You betcha.
All right, G. Take care, man. We'll talk to you soon.
Right. Bye. See ya.